with those interviews and more. Find it online at WORTFM.org/candidates and find what you need to be ready to vote. That's at myvote.wi.gov. Say it's my country.
The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, March 27th. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. In tonight's news, Madison's new legislative lobbyist shares a sneak peek into their strategy.
An incumbent alder who's running unopposed this spring says students need a voice in city politics.
And in the second half, Transparency Talk has recommendations to make open records stronger. Fishy Business shares some spots to cast your line. And Forward Focus sits down with the Mingo's midfielder.
All these stories and more on tonight's news. But first, we'll go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has said the United States is no longer a reliable partner and Canada will need to dramatically reduce its reliance on the US. Speaking after President Trump announced tariffs on all imports of cars, Mr. Carney said Canada will protect its national interests.
I reject any attempts to weaken Canada, to wear us down, to break us so that America can own us. That will never happen. And our response to these latest tariffs is to fight, is to protect, and to build. We will fight the U.S. tariffs with retaliatory trade actions of our own that will have maximum impact in the United States and minimum impacts here in Canada.
Mr. Carney said he'd be speaking to Mr. Trump in the coming days. President Putin has said geopolitical competition in the Arctic is intensifying, and Russia thinks the U.S. plan to acquire Greenland is serious. He said the U.S. ambition to take over Greenland had long-standing historical roots, but he said the situation had nothing to do with Russia. King Charles has spent a short time in hospital after experiencing temporary side effects from his cancer treatment. His engagements for Friday have been cancelled. The 76-year-old British monarch was diagnosed with an undisclosed form of cancer in February last year. An official statement was released earlier. Ben Schofield explains.
That statement from Buckingham Palace talking about the side effects that he has encountered as a result of his treatment. But palace sources saying that that's no surprise that these sorts of side effects are common when it comes to this type of treatment. They say that they are temporary and such issues are not uncommon with medical treatments. We know that the King spent some time in hospital today. He went back to the London clinic, which is where he was initially diagnosed and is now recovering at home in Clarence House.
The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has called a general election for the 3rd of May. He said the world was an uncertain place, but he was convinced it was a time for Australia to build its security and prosperity. The announcement ends months of speculation and begins 5 weeks of campaigning. From Sydney, Katie Watson sent this report.
The biggest issue facing Australians in these elections is a cost of living crisis. But the rising concern over tariffs and global trade wars will no doubt lead voters to also ask who will be best placed to deal with Donald Trump. The world today is an uncertain place, said Mr. Albanese, but now is not the time for cutting and wrecking, for aiming low, punching down or looking back. Words aimed at his rival Peter Dutton. But the race between Labour and the Coalition will be tight. With the rise of independents or minor parties, many are expecting a hung parliament.
Katie Watson reporting. This is the latest world news from the BBC. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has warned Venezuela not to escalate its territorial claims against neighboring Guyana, which recently discovered huge oil reserves. He said any attack on Guyana by Venezuela would not end well. The Venezuelan foreign minister dismissed Mr. Rubio's warning as bluster. President Trump has withdrawn his choice of U.S. ambassador to the United Nations over concerns that the Republicans could lose her seat in Congress. Elise Stefanik currently serves as a representative for New York. Here's Nada Taufik.
Elise Stefanik was the president's first cabinet pick and a tough critic of the UN. Her long-delayed confirmation was supposed to move to a vote after a pair of special election races in Florida on April 1st, including for a seat left vacant by Mike Waltz, the current national security advisor. Those races are now closer than anticipated, leaving Republicans worried about their slim majority in the House of Representatives. The one-time Trump critic turned MAGA darling was expected to sail through Senate confirmation. There is no indication yet who will replace her. President Trump said there were others that could do a good job.
Six Russian tourists are confirmed dead and four other people are in critical condition after a tourist submarine sank off the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Hurghada. 39 foreign passengers and five Egyptian crew members were rescued. The submarine, which can descend to a depth of 25 metres, was taking the tourists to view coral reefs. Russians form a sizable portion of foreign visitors to Egypt's Red Sea resorts. Bosnia has issued an international arrest warrant for the Bosnian Serb leader Milorad Dodik, who's accused of undermining the constitutional order. The head of the semi-autonomous Republika Srpska has repeatedly threatened to secede from Bosnia and barred federal police from working in his region. Speaking from Israel, he described the warrant as an abuse of Bosnia's justice system. BBC News.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Leffering with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. Anonymous donors have sunk more than $26 million in dark money into this spring's race for Wisconsin Supreme Court, according to the Capital Times. Independent spending by groups that are unaffiliated with the candidate's campaign or political party do not have to reveal the source of the money they spend on advertising. Those groups include two political action organizations affiliated with billionaire Elon Musk. In total, independent political groups supporting conservative candidate Brad Schimmel have raised $31 million, while groups supporting liberal candidate Susan Crawford have raised $16 million, reports the investigative Badger report. That brings the campaign bankroll behind Schimmel to $41 million to Crawford's $36 million, the Badger report concludes today.
Elon Musk says he'll give $1 million to a Green Bay man, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Musk announced the gift Wednesday night on his social media platform X. He did not specify why the man was chosen or what he did to qualify for the money. Musk's political action committee, America First, previously offered $100 to voters who signed a petition opposing so-called activist judges. The billionaire has funneled millions of dollars supporting the campaign of conservative Supreme Court candidate Brad Schimmel.
The Trump administration's budget cuts targeting the National Institutes of Health are disrupting decades of research into Alzheimer's disease, cancer, and other devastating illnesses, researchers and patients told Senate Democrats on Wednesday. According to the Wisconsin Examiner, Dr. Sterling Johnson of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center told senators that the disruptions are setting back progress by researchers and by patients battling the disease. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin led Wednesday's forum as the ranking Democrat on a Senate subcommittee that oversees the NIH.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call announced he has joined 20 other state attorneys general in filing a motion for a preliminary injunction to stop President Trump from dismantling large parts of the Department of Education. The injunction filed Monday is part of a lawsuit to block Trump from moving forward on announced plans to lay off half the department's staff and transfer student loan and special education services outside the department. Call and other attorneys general argue that Trump's efforts to reduce the department, which was created by an act of Congress, are unconstitutional.
Governor Tony Evers announced today he is establishing a recruitment portal and other employment services for federal workers whose jobs were targeted by the Trump administration. Evers also announced through the State Department of Workforce Development that 8 virtual job fairs will take place through April to help fired federal workers and other displaced professionals find new employment. Details about the job fair are available on the Department of Workforce Development's website.
some federal grant money for lower-income households in Madison for home improvement appear to be on hold due to actions by the Trump administration, the Cap Times reports today. A $20 million community change grant from the Environmental Protection Agency was intended to finance home energy upgrades. That grant has been suspended, said Jessica Price, Madison's Sustainability and Resilience Manager.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison is tightening the purse strings on budgeting by vice chancellors following the discovery of controversial spending in the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Department. The Wisconsin State Journal reports today that vice chancellors no longer can carry over more than 10% of their budgets from one year to the next, eliminating a privilege former DEI vice chancellor LeVar Charleston used to give almost $250,000 in bonuses last year. Between 2022 and 2024, the department's salary budget grew by 59%, while some employees received bonuses equal to 8 or 9% of their wages, the State Journal reports. Charleston's spending came to light after Republicans requested an audit of DEI programs across the government. Charleston was removed from the vice chancellor's post in January, and he returned to his job as a clinical professor in the UW's education department.
And Robert McChesney, a author, educator, host, and journalist who warned of the deterioration of the media ecosystem and called for a robust free press, has died at the age of 72. McChesney passed away on Tuesday after a battle with cancer. From 1988 to 1998, he was on the journalism and mass communication faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And near the end of his tenure in Madison, he hosted public affairs programs on WORT, largely focused on the evolution and future of journalism. After a move to join the communications faculty at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, he hosted the radio program Media Matters on Illinois Public Radio. McChesney was a prolific author. His book centered around the themes of democracy, communications, and capitalism. In a remembrance published by The Nation earlier today, journalist John Nichols touted McChesney's, quote, capacity for communicating his vision of a media that served citizens rather than corporations. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Madison Alders approved a contract late last month with an outside consultant to lobby for the city's interest in the state legislature. A presentation at this week's city council meeting provided a sneak peek into their strategy. WORT producer, news producer Faye Parks has the story.
Madison voters approved a budget referendum in November that raised property taxes, a temporary stopgap for the city's structural deficit. The referendum had its critics, some of which were led by former Madison Mayor Paul Soglin. Soglin held a press conference a month before Election Day, urging Madisonians to vote no and force the city to explore other options, like drawing down the city's rainy day fund. Soglin also argued that Madison hasn't done enough in recent years to push its interests in the state capital, interests like getting a larger cut of shared revenue.
To work effectively with state government, you have to lobby, and you have to be able to talk with both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats.
Madison leaders took Soglin's advice late last month and approved a contract with the Welch Group, one of the largest lobby firms in the state. Under the contract, the Welch Group will help build relationships with state legislators and the executive branch. It will also track legislation that impacts Madison and otherwise develop political strategies for passing legislation that serves the city's interests. For those lobbying services, Madison taxpayers will foot $72,000 over the next year. Representatives from the Welch Group joined the city council meeting on Tuesday to present a broad overview of their lobbying strategy. Peter Welch, the firm's managing partner, urged Madison Alders to narrow focus on a handful of issues and present a united front.
You come to the legislature and say, these are our 9 priorities. They're not going to be as receptive as you saying, these are our 2 priorities, and here's why we think we can get them done.
The firm's strategy does involve sending alders to the state capitol to speak directly with state lawmakers, but
that's going to be strategically deployed, right? You need to trust us and our counsel on when does that need to happen and in what manner does it need to happen.
The right time will come, Welch says, once the city has built a strong coalition with other Wisconsin municipalities with similar interests.
Those strategies can bring in an alliance that maybe carries more people who have less baggage, frankly, than the city of Madison does with the legislature.
Jim Steinecke, vice president of advocacy at the firm, also spoke at Tuesday's meeting. Steinecke, a Republican, served in the state assembly for almost 11 years before becoming a lobbyist. He touted the relationships they've already built in the state capitol and how they'll serve the city's interests.
We know which buttons to push. We know their districts. We know kind of where they're coming from and what their ideas are and what their sensitivities are. So those are things that we can use in our strategy. Our pitch when we go into lawmakers is almost never exactly the same because it will depend on who we're talking to at any given time, you know, what we highlight in our conversations. And that's an important part of this advocacy process is knowing these people. You know, I go out and have a beer with Democrats and Republicans quite often, getting to know them personally, their likes, their dislikes, you know, how many kids they have and where they grew up, things like that. Developing those personal relationships is really important.
Other clients that have retained the Welch Group include the Green Bay Packers, Wisconsin Nurses Association, and Wisconsin Corn Growers Association. City staff members interviewed several firms before settling on a non-competitive contract with Welch, reports the Capital Times. The hiring process has its critics. Rick Cruz, a city council candidate who was eliminated in the February primary, wrote in a public comment last month that the non-competitive bidding process was financially irresponsible. Cruz also writes that outsourcing to a lobbyist undermines government transparency. Alder Nikki Conklin asked on Tuesday how frequently the firm would check in with the city council for progress updates, and Steinecke conceded that compared to Welch's clients in the private sector, representing a municipality requires more secrecy.
I remember when we had some questions early on in the council when we were first going through the process, there was some talk about, where's the strategy? Give us the strategy. It's really hard to do. We can do that with clients that aren't subject to open records requests and videotaping meetings, but it's very difficult to do for folks like you without tipping our hand. It's like going into a football game and giving the other team your playbook. That can be challenging. So just something to remember as well.
The City of Madison will pay the Welch Group $6,000 monthly to retain their services until December 31st of this year, with the option to extend the contract for another 2 years after that. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's now 6:18 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Alder MGR Govindarajan has served on the City Council since 2023. He's one of a handful of incumbent alders who are running unopposed this spring. His name is the only one that'll appear on the ballot for voters in Campus Area District 8. In his second term, Alder Govindarajan wants to lower the cost of rent, expand walkable street infrastructure, and give students a voice in city politics. Sitting down with WORT reporter Sutton Johnson, Alder Govindarajan outlined his vision for the city of Madison.
My name is MGR Govindarajan. I am the District 8 Alder currently, and I'm seeking re-election. I have almost completed my first term. Currently, my day job is to work in the state capitol. I work in the assembly for Representative Christian Phelps. I'm his legislative assistant in the capitol. I've lived in Madison coming up on 5 years now. I moved here when I started going to UW-Madison.
Now, why are you running again?
Students represented is such a huge and pivotal part of Madison as a city. but it felt like we didn't really have a meaningful voice when it comes to city matters. I wanted the student perspective to be taken into account, and I want to continue that for one more year. I want to finish up a couple of the projects that I'm currently working on.
What is one specific achievement that you drove forward in your latest term on the council?
It was in collaboration with Alder Juliana Bennett to bring together a group of individuals and organizations, essentially a public-private partnership to address the housing crisis for students. But essentially, it brought together lawyers and developers and property management, along with the university, city officials, planning divisions, and a whole bunch of other folks. And about the 25 of us basically discussed student housing. What were the problems? And then how can we provide solutions? We made several recommendations to the Housing Strategy Committee and then later to the Common Council. And those recommendations are now being looked at by the city officials, city staff, as we now plan ahead when it comes to student housing. We did like a pretty large market analysis and then also a student survey. And we put it together, created these recommendations, and now the city is going to be able to implement policies with those recommendations.
What is one policy you tried to get accomplished but didn't?
My big goal was to make it so students have easy communication with the city. Whenever the city is creating a project, it should be the responsibility of the city to reach out to its constituents, its entire community, and that includes students. And it's gotten better over the past couple of years, but I think there's so much more that we can do.
What did you spend the most time on in your latest term on the council?
Educating my community on, like, the city government. We control so much of your day-to-day activities, whether it's the buses, whether it's the sidewalks or even, whether there's enough tree canopy. If your apartment building doesn't have heat turned on and it's negative 20 degrees outside, you reach out to the building inspection and then they will make sure that your heating is turned on as soon as possible.
A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming house cost burdened correlates to a full-time job paying about $28 per hour. Or about $58,000 a year. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
Honestly, it sounds really simple, but the answer is just to be able to build more. The more that we are able to build housing, the lower we're able to get the prices of rent to increase. In 2022, the average student rent went up about 8.4%. Now in 2024, we're ending that with about 3.4%. Students used to get renewal offers for $200 a month, like an increase of $200. And now they're seeing it close to about like $50-ish dollars a month instead, which is much more manageable, much more stable. So when you take that out and zoom it out into the big picture of the entire city, I think that would be a sustainable model to continue.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes?
Madison has about 50% of all state properties in the entire state, but we provide sewer services, we provide fire and police to these state properties, like the university. But the state only reimburses us at a rate of about one-third. But if they reimburse us at 100%, I believe it's going to be like $30 or $35 million additional dollars that we would get from the state.
Is there another issue you're excited to work on if you're elected?
My district is one of the most transient districts in the entire city. Students are moving every year from house to house, but also many of them don't own a car. We walk, we take the bus, and we bike. Very few of us actually drive. I've been pushing hard to invest more bike infrastructure into downtown Madison. We have a lot of good infrastructure already, but we don't really have safe ones as much as we could. So what I've done in the past is District 8, for the first time in several years, has actually gotten almost $150,000 in transportation infrastructure when it comes to like putting down new green bike lanes or expanding it, things like that. So that's something I'm looking forward to. But obviously, it's something much smaller on scale.
You represent a lot of students, and particularly students on the UW-Madison campus. You're also one of the youngest alders on the council, and this seat tends to run younger. I'm wondering if you can reflect on any generational divides as the council or city government approaches big issues.
It's been one of the most unique perspectives and growing opportunities I've had as a human being. 2 years ago, it was my first time working with folks who are double, triple my ages. And there is that generational gap. And I've found a lot of value in that, being able to talk to folks who have very differing life experiences than me and different backgrounds. And I've been able to work with just about every member of council to achieve something that would benefit both of our communities. I appreciate being able to have students behind me. They have always been supportive of me. I feel like I can take that extra risk. I can go that extra step, and my community will have my back. Yes, I have 14,000 people in District 8, but I feel like I represent the broader student community in the city of Madison, honestly.
The council has a high turnover rate, with elections every 2 years. And even then, some alders resign early, largely over the time commitment. How much time would you say you spend being an alder each week?
Probably about 25 hours a week. Just preparing for a committee meeting takes an hour or two. Preparing for common council takes several hours. And then the meetings themselves take 2 to 4 hours, typically. It takes a lot of time. There have been times where sometimes I only work 5 weeks, but that's because it's Christmas break. Actually, there's been 1 week where I did work 86 hours. The UW-Madison community had the encampment protest taking place, and I was actively on the scene trying to help folks get the information that they need, working with MPD, UWPD, the university, and the protesters. It is a very tough job. I don't think most people realize how tough it's going to be, because you just don't expect a local government to be as active as it is, but Madison is very unique. We're a very active city. We're a very, very educated city where everyone is kind of involved in one way or another. So there's a lot to do as an elected official. If I wanted to introduce an ordinance, on average, I would be working about 35 to 40 hours a week. But if I'm not introducing an ordinance, then for those couple months, I'll be averaging about 25. About a year ago now, I was very much in support of raising the alder wage. I do think that people should be paid something that they can live on and something that is reflective of the work that they are giving to the community. Now, I'm not saying it should be like $100,000 or something. I was just saying essentially it should be double.
The council has also grappled with the question of whether to censor a fellow alder and is having ongoing discussions about what to do when a colleague faces severe allegations. It is a bit of a different situation when someone's elected rather than hired by the city. How has your thinking evolved about the personnel of who is on the council and what checks and balances should be in place?
As you know, I was the lead sponsor on the censure resolution. I worked with the mayor on removing Alder Maiadzi from his committee. I personally do think that the Common Council should move forward to removing him from his position as an alder, but I don't know if there's an appetite for that, knowing that there is an election. It's also a very rough process. You have to essentially hold a hearing and have witnesses. The question is, should the council bring in a bunch of witnesses and have them testify in front of the 20 of us, including Charles Maiadzi, and then potentially not have the votes to remove him? I'm glad that District 18, one way or another, will have new representation going forward.
Let's end this interview on a smaller, fun note. What do you do in your spare time? What's a hobby that our listeners might be surprised to hear?
In the daytime, I work in the Capitol, and then in the evenings, I work on city council. It's just politics one time after another. I really enjoy reading books. My sister and I read books every so often. She picks a book, and then we both read them, and then I pick a book, and we both read them. She's in eighth grade right now, so currently we are both reading the Percy Jackson series.
Govindarajan is running unopposed in the spring election and will be on the April 1st election ballot.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
Transparency Talk has recommendations to make open records stronger. Fishy Business shares some spots to cast your line. And Forward Focus sits down with a Mingo's midfielder.
But first, we'll take a quick break, check in on some world headlines, and we'll be right back.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney has said his country needs to dramatically reduce its reliance on the US, as it's no longer a reliable partner. He was speaking after President Trump announced tariffs on all imports of cars and car parts. Mr. Carney said Canada would announce its countermeasures next week and that nothing was off the table. President Putin has said geopolitical competition in the Arctic is intensifying. But speaking in Murmansk, he said US plans to annex Greenland had nothing to do with Russia. King Charles has spent a short time in hospital after experiencing temporary side effects from his cancer treatment. His engagements for Friday have been cancelled. The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has called a general election for the 3rd of May. He said his Labour Party had created strong foundations and warned that the opposition Liberals would leave Australians worse off if they returned to office. The head of BBC News, Deborah Turnus, says the corporation will make representations to the Turkish authorities after one of its correspondents was deported. Mark Lowen was in Turkey to cover the recent anti-government protests. The Venezuelan leader, Nicolas Maduro, has branded the US Secretary of State an imbecile after Marco Rubio warned Venezuela not to escalate its territorial dispute with Guyana. Mr. Rubio had said any Venezuelan aggression would not end well. A US judge has ordered the Trump administration to preserve messages from a Signal chat group used by senior national security officials to discuss plans to attack the Houthis in Yemen. The group, set up by the National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, mistakenly included the Atlantic magazine editor Jeffrey Goldberg. And six Russian tourists are confirmed dead, and four other people are in critical condition after a tourist submarine sank off the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Hurghada. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
Every other Thursday, journalist Bill Leaders and government transparency lawyer Tom Kamenick sit down to give you a few tips about open meetings and open government. We call it Transparency Talk. In this edition, Bill and Tom follow up on Sunshine Week with a few ways Wisconsin's decades-old open records law could be better. As always, this conversation isn't specific legal advice, it's just good sense. Seek an attorney's assistance if you have a specific problem with open records or open government.
Today is every other Thursday, which means it's time for Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through. I'm Bill Leaders, and I'm the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group that promotes open government. And I'm here with Tom Kamenick, the founder and president of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, a law firm devoted to open government issues. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Bill.
Well, last week was Sunshine Week, a national celebration of transparency in government, and several outlets used this as an opportunity to suggest ways that the state's openness laws can be improved. Today, we're going to focus on two of those efforts. The first is an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on how the state open records law could be better, in which both Tom and I were quoted. The second is a report titled Shining a Light, which was produced by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative legal group where you, Tom, used to work. I'd just like to mention that while this group, commonly known as WILL, embraces a lot of what one might call, or I might call, illiberal causes, its commitment to open government runs deep and is sincere. Wouldn't you agree, Tom?
Well, I wouldn't say WILL is illiberal, but you and I might disagree on that. But we certainly agree that WILL has had a focus since its beginning on government transparency. Fun fact, the first lawsuit it ever filed was an open meetings lawsuit. We won that against the Milwaukee County Board because they tried to amend an agenda less than 24 hours in advance of a meeting to address redistricting after the 2010 census.
Let's take a look at some of the problems that were identified and the solutions that were proposed in the Journal Sentinel article and in the WILL report. And we'll start with one of the biggest problem areas, that of long waits between when records are requested and when they are released. The open records law says that records must be provided as soon as practicable and without delay. But it doesn't say how long is too long. And so frequently we see waits of weeks, months, even more than a year for records to be provided. Tom, what can be done about it?
Both the Journal Sentinel article and WILL report talked about setting clear response deadlines in the law. WILL suggested a 14-day deadline to respond with a statutory maximum of about 60 days. The Journal Sentinel points at many of our neighboring states, which have response periods of 5 to 20 days in them.
When the law was first proposed, the drafters didn't want to put a time limit in because they felt that if they said you have 10 days to provide records, that custodians would take 10 days when they should be turning it over in 10 minutes. So I think the language that would be useful to have would be something like records need to be provided as soon as practicable and without delay, but in no case should someone wait more than 14 days for an answer, and in no case should someone wait more than 60 days for records. Moving on, both the Journal Sentinel and WILL also complained about the high fees that are sometimes charged for records, especially the cost that is related to locating records. What can be done about that?
What should be done is that threshold should be raised or even eliminated. It was set at $50 as a minimum charge for location costs in 1981, but that would be well over $150 now if it was adjusted for inflation. So Governor Evers, in this current proposed two-year state budget, as well as his last two or three of them, has called to raise that threshold to $100. Personally, I think allowing them to charge any location fees at all just incentivizes them to keep records in a disorganized manner and use inflated location costs to scare off any requesters.
Just for clarity, these thresholds are when you make a request, the custodian has to find the record and provide it, and they can only charge you for the cost of finding it if that cost exceeds a certain amount. Statutorily, it's been $50, and as you say, the proposal is to raise it to at least $100, a free search time that a requester gets before they are asked to start footing the bill. Another problem is that records custodians will claim that certain records are exempt because they're considered a draft or are a privileged attorney-client communication. What can be done about that, as suggested by these two reports?
You know, I don't think there's a good reason for that drafts exemption. It's all part of the process of developing legislation or governmental matters, so why not shine some light on that? I agree with your comments, too, in the Journal Sentinel article about the attorney-client privilege. I don't think it needs to be as broad as it is. I think once any immediate need for secrecy disappears, say while litigation is pending or while negotiations are ongoing, after the fact, I think the public deserves to see whether that legal advice that they paid for was any good, and two, whether their elected officials are listening to it.
There's also a problem that was created by a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision a couple years back in a case known as Friends of Frame Park versus the City of Waukesha. There, the court undercut the ability of a requester to recover legal fees in cases where records are provided only after a lawsuit is filed. Why is this a problem, and how can we fix it?
That decision made it a lot harder to get fees because it lets custodians essentially reverse course and turn over the records after they're sued without having to face any real consequences. Now, there was a bill to fix that passed the Senate unanimously last term. It died in the Assembly, but it has been reintroduced this year, and we hope it moves forward.
I should mention that from the very moment that this decision was rendered in 2022, Will has been leading the charge to have it overturned, even though the ruling was made by the court's conservative majority, back when conservatives were in the court majority. As a final item in the Shining a Light report, Will called for greater transparency with regard to information about records requests. Tom, what can records keepers do to be more transparent about transparency?
Under previous Governor Scott Walker's administration, the state agencies kept publicly accessible logs of record requests and response times up on their websites. That was a great idea. We'd love to see it come back. And it would also be helpful if public entities designated a public records officer and made it easy to figure out who that person was, identify them on their website, and have clear directions for how to make requests.
One more question. What has to happen for these improvements to occur?
You know, it might be time for the legislature to put together a committee to shore up some of these laws' weaknesses. We've had the records law in its modern form for over 40 years now, and it needs some updating.
I agree. I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think we should try to move forward with that to convene, maybe through the Attorney General's office, some sort of committee to take a look at the need to make changes in the law. Maybe a legislative council committee would be in order. So that's all the time that we have for today. I'm Bill Leaders, here with Tom Kamenick. Thanks to Shelley Pittman for producing. We'll be back in 2 weeks for another installment of Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through.
It's my pleasure, Bill. And remember, everybody, if you don't ask, you won't know.
Springtime is officially here, which means the flowers are blooming, the birds are returning north, and it's impossible to know if you can go fishing more than a day ahead. But that's okay, because after a few months inside, Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg are ready to hit the water. They break down what's biting and where on this week's Fishy Business.
Alrighty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hansberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, the spring is fully here, which is to say that I have no idea what the weather is going to be at any given day. It kind of feels like one day it's, you know, up in the 60s to 70s and nice and perfect fishing weather, and then the next day it's in the 40s and rainy and just not very fun. So, Pat, just sort of as a whole, around the area in both the lakes and rivers, how have the fish been biting?
Well, it's been good. I mean, it's springtime, so there's a lot of good fishing to be had. But you're right, the roller coaster weather we experience every March is, you know, something that can be great for the fishing. If you get a warm day that comes along, you get a cold day, it can sometimes shut the fishing down. And, you know, there's always wind has been a problem, at least as of late. So you never really know what to expect when you're out there. But there's a lot of great opportunities to be had all around the area, whether it's rivers or streams for trout or, you know, lakes for mostly panfish this time of year because game fish season is closed on inland lakes. But yeah, a lot of great angling to be had.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are like me and a little bit having cabin fever right now, so willing to put up with a little bit worse weather to get a little bit of fishing in. So let's start going. Let's just start off with all of the lakes as a whole. Now, game fish season is closed at the moment. So just sort of looking at Madison's lakes as a whole, what's sort of happening around town?
Well, you know, we just lost our ice a couple of weeks ago here, so the water is still very cold. And so all of your fish are generally up shallow right now, enjoying that water that tends to warm up first. So, you know, if it's panfish you're after, there's been some great action in areas like Monona Bay, University Bay, North Bay and Lake Mendota. Anywhere you can find some shallow water on any of the lakes, you're likely going to find some panfish around there, which are, of course, still legal to catch. You can still fish for bass. Of course, they do have to be released immediately. So there's that opportunity too. And a lot of bass are up again, enjoying that shallow water. You can't fish for walleye or pike or muskies around town, but that's what the rivers are for.
And speaking of the rivers, springtime to me is sort of river fishing time. So let's start going through them, and I want to hit them one by one. And I want to start with the Wisconsin River, heading out west a little bit. What are you hearing coming out of there?
Well, the rivers, the Wisconsin River in particular this time of year is a great spot to look for walleye and sauger. You're going to be looking at mostly at dams, so Prairie du Sac, Wisconsin Dells, Castle Rock, Pettenwell Dams are all good spots because those walleyes are heading upstream and they tend to back up at these dams. Right now, a lot of the action I'm hearing about is mostly smaller males that tend to, jump the gun there. They get a little excited and they run upstream, but they're waiting for the females to show up. And I have heard about a few nice females being caught, but a week or a little more here, it's going to be full game on for nice big females that are up there getting ready to spawn. And then they make for impressive pictures. They're a lot of times full of eggs. It can be great. But then after they spawn, the post-spawn bite is when you can really, really get some good numbers.
And now heading east, I know the Rock River can be a little different sometimes. So what are you hearing out of there?
Pretty much the same thing. I mean, dams are where you're going to find most of your action. Or, I should say, you can, this goes for the Wisconsin River as well. You can fish the dams, but also, check out deeper holes below dams because they kind of stage there, I guess you'd call it. But Rock River is the same thing. You got Indian Ford Dam and Jefferson Dam. Both those are great spots to look for walleyes this time of year. And I've been hearing about some nice fish actually coming out of those spots.
Now, a little bit smaller water, but certainly closer to home, I do want to talk about the Yahara River a little bit. Are you hearing about anyone getting anything out of there?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Yahara River is that they close a lot of sections of the Yahara River as fish refuges for this time of year. So a perfect example is right here in downtown Madison at Tenney Park. They close the area below the Tenney Locks because fish swim out of the lakes and then kind of congregate up there. Right now, you can go down to Tenney and probably see some giant walleyes and muskies swimming below the bridge there. And it's tempting especially in an urban environment, for folks to want to chase those fish. All the way down to as far as like Dunkirk and Dayton, at almost every dam, it's considered a fish refuge. So do be careful where you fish. I know you can fish like below the Stoughton Dam. And there again, you're going to find walleyes, any number of fish back up down there. But a lot of walleyes this time of year, getting ready to do their spawning.
Now, moving away from rivers, so to speak, and moving more towards streams, and more specifically trout streams, the trout bite. Now, we are still in catch and release for a couple more weeks here, so can't be keeping anything. You can't be using live bait or anything. But what are you hearing about the trout bite right now?
Well, the trout bite's been great. I mean, we're well past our snow melt, which, that cold snow melt can kind of slow down the bite for a lot of folks. But, the conditions have been actually pretty great for trout fishing. The water temps are kind of stabilized now. The only complaint that I've heard has been the wind. And then sometimes, we haven't had a lot of rain, and so the water can be very clear, and so you got spooky fish. So being stealthy and trying to avoid wearing bright colors when you're walking the banks there can really help improve your chances of getting trout.
Well, Pat, that's all the water we're going to talk about here today. Do you have just any final fishing advice for all the people out there on spring fishing as a whole?
Well, like you were saying, the winter's past us and a lot of folks just want to get outside, and spring's a great time to be doing that, especially trout fishing. Get out and explore some streams that you might not otherwise hit during the middle of the summer, and just get out there and do it. I mean, just enjoy the great fishing that our area has to offer.
Well, that'll do it for this week. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime that you want just by calling one simple, easy-to-remember number. That's 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thanks for talking with me, and good luck out there.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Nate. You take care. Good luck.
The time is 6:48, and you're listening to Live Local News on WORT. after forward Madison started their USL League One season with a disappointing shutout against Naples, the team bounced back in style just 5 days later in the Flamingos' first round U.S. Open Cup matchup versus Duluth FC. All-League midfielder Devin Boyce joins Andrew and Grant in this week's installment of Forward Focus.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT Online at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Forward Madison themed magazine, New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last joined you, Forward Madison were preparing to open up the 2025 regular season on the road on March 15th, when they traveled to Florida to take on USL1 newcomers Naples FC. Fielding a squad that was missing goalkeeper Baron Shipman and 2025 USL1 first-teamers Mitch Osman and Devin Boyce, the Flamingos would struggle to get anything moving offensively, and after two defensive lapses, ended up taking the season opener on the chin, losing the match 2-0. Forward Madison would have a chance to rebound last Thursday when they opened up play in the 2025 U.S. Open Cup against Duluth FC at Bree Stevens Field. Following a red card and immediate dismissal from the match by Duluth's Alexander Mihoff, FMFC would open up the scoring when Faraday Sosa slipped a ball past the keeper to give the Flamingos a 1-0 lead. A shock equalizer by a 10-man Duluth would be countered by four unanswered goals by Forward Madison, with Boyce assisting on three of them. Newcomer Eddie Munjoma and returning John Murphy would notch their first two goals of the season, with Juan Galindres bagging a brace, hopefully giving Forward Madison fans a glimpse of the goal-scoring prowess he's shown throughout his career. All in all, it was a great night for the Forward faithful as FMFC cruised to a 5-1 victory, moving them on into the next round of the tournament. For this week's segment, the aforementioned Devin Boyce came on to the most recent episode of the NDZ Live podcast to give his thoughts on the weekend's upcoming matchup in the Henny Derby against the Richmond Kickers, and also discuss the club's recent signing of 18-year-old Riley Binns to an academy contract and what that means for the club this season and beyond. Andrew, take it away.
The last time our guest was on was episode 47, almost 30 episodes ago.
Wow.
In April of 2024, it was titled "The Boyce is Back in Town." We had our guest
shout
tonight,
out Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, we had our guest tonight on with Kristen Chaney in that episode, but we are Chaneyless tonight. We have Devin Boyce in the hot seat. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Good to be back. I appreciate that. I mean, I didn't realize it had been this long. That doesn't make me look too great, but I'm happy to be here.
Your Open Cup performance was a bit of a... I feel like the team's Open Cup performance was a bit of a statement. How do you carry that into that form into the Henny Derby this weekend?
I'm always of the belief that if you truly believe in that you're the better side, you need to focus on what Absolutely. It is that you're doing and implement, right. You know, play your game, and then that should shine through on the weekend. So we're just focused on ourselves, and we'll have a good game plan kind of going into it.
So Derby's a big one, especially on the fan side, as we take this very seriously with Richmond.
Yeah.
How much is that an impact in the locker room? Like, how serious is that something that you guys talked about? You know, is that like this is a derby match?
It definitely gets brought up. I mean, we were cluing in some of the new boys about the, you know, the bottle of Henny that is traded amongst the fans. Yeah. We discussed some of the drama that happened last year on at their place.
With their fans?
With their fans, with us losing in the final minute, with, you know, it was obviously a big disappointment for us last year on the road that, mm-hmm. You know, I can tell the guys are motivated by it. And you know, not I wouldn't say it's so much focus on the fact that it's the Henny Derby, but it's a game that against a team that, you know, we like to compete with and we want to beat. So mm-hmm. we're excited about it. Mm.
The club announced today a signing of 18-year-old Riley Binns from Greenfield, Wisconsin.
Top Binns.
Yeah, on an academy contract.
Second ever academy contract for forward Madison. Yeah. The other was Tino Vasquez a couple years ago.
You mentioned before we started recording that he actually was around part of last season as well, doing some training.
Only in the preseason.
Yeah. But what have been your impressions of him in training?
Oh, he's great. He's awesome. He's very young. He's figuring himself out. I think he's in a perfect environment to better himself. I think we have a lot of mature guys that have been around that can kind of show him the ropes on things. But it's a different age, you know. Guys are signing in and out at a younger age to get into a professional environment. Him personally, I mean, he's super technical. He's a really good player. He shows a lot of talent. Great on the ball. Like, I remember first day he came trading down when we were training in Rockford, and a bunch of us were just kind of looking at each other like, this kid's great. You know, yeah. He's awesome. Yeah. And even Matt was like, oh man, he's, you know, obviously really impressed. And so, yeah, I think it is going to be, you know, now he's entering in the journey of all of it, where it's a long road to full of you know, dips and valleys that you have to experience to be a professional soccer player, that I think he's willing to embrace. And I think that he's come in with a great attitude, wants to learn from the guys, and then, you know, he's just a great kid. So it'll be a good year for him, and he's under contract. Like, he can help us win. He's young, but obviously at some point he's going to be called upon. So then it's his time to step up, which was exciting.
Forward Madison will be back in action this Saturday, as they'll be on the road to take on the Richmond Kickers in this year's first matchup of the coveted Henny Derby. Kickoff will be at 5 p.m. local time, and live coverage will be available on ESPN+. Forward Madison will then continue play in the 2025 U.S. Open Cup on April 2nd at the friendly confines of Bree Stevens Field when they take on USL Championship squad Tulsa FC. Kickoff will be at 6:30 p.m., and tickets are now available. Live coverage of the match will be available on YouTube. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us throughout the season as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Forward Madison begins their quest for USL 1 glory in the 2025 season. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
That's a wrap for WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporter this evening was Sutton Johnson. Special thanks to feature contributors Bill Leaders, Tom Kamenik, Nate Wiegehout, and Pat Hansberg, and the Forward Focus crew. Katie Gergella engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Ms. Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Gamma Ray welcomes MSSV with Hot Probs and the Mothballs on Thursday, April 17th at 8 p.m. MSSV, guitarist Mike Baghetta, drummer Stephen Hodges, and master bassist Mike Watt create a hybrid of punk power trio and dreamy experimental rock. Mr. Watt offers the best-known pedigree, he of Minutemen and Firehose fame, but Hodges has worked with Tom Waits and David Lynch, and Baghetta has played with Psychic Temple, Jeff Coffin, Henry Kaiser, and the Reverend Fred Lane. The trio's music is full of memorable hooks and noir-tinged adventure, with vocals from all three. MSSV's third full-length record comes out this spring, and this show offers local support from heavy hitters Hot Probs and the Mothballs. More information at gammaray.bar. The Gamma Ray welcomes MSSV, Mike Baghetta, Stephen Hodges, and Mike Watt, with Hot Probs and the Mothballs, Thursday, April 17th at 8 p.m. This ain't no picnic. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
It's the Perpetual Notion Machine, edition March 27th.